Indian Uncles by Ursula Kroeber Le Guin. From a talk given for the Emeriti Lectures at the Department of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, November 4, 1991. I rewrote the piece for a celebration of the 100th anniversary of the department, November 16, 2001. Because I was talking to people who knew my background, some of them perhaps better than I did, and all the people I mentioned, I did no explaining. Therefore, a few explanations are in order. Alfred L. Kroeber, my father, founded that department in 1901 and taught in it till he retired in 1947. He married Theodora Craycall Brown, my mother, in 1925. We lived in Berkeley near the campus. In 1911, a wild Indian appeared in a small Northern California town. He spoke a language the remaining local Indians did not know, and had evidently lived his entire life in hiding with the remnant of his people from the whites. A linguist from the university, T.T. Waterman, was able to talk a little with him and brought him down to the Museum of Anthropology, then in San Francisco. He lived there from then on, learning the ways of the new world he had entered and teaching the ways of his own lost world to the scientists and to visitors to the museum. His people did not name themselves to others, so he was called Ishi, which means man, in his own Yahi language. I relate below how my mother became Ishi's biographer. Her books about him are Ishi in Two Worlds and Ishi, Last of His Tribe. His story is, I think, essential reading to anyone who thinks they know or wants to learn how the West was won and who Americans are. Many, many people have asked me, eager and expectant, wasn't it wonderful to know Ishi? And I'm floored every time. All I can do is disappoint them by explaining that Ishi died 13 years before I was born. I can't remember even hearing his name until the late 50s, when a biography of him became first a subject of family conversation, and then the consuming object of my mother's work and thought for several years. But my father, in my recollection, didn't talk about Ishi. He talked very little about the past. He didn't reminisce. As a man 20 years older than his wife, a father of grandfather age, he may well have determined never to be a garrulous old bore bleating about the good old days. But also by temperament he didn't live in the past, but in the present, in the moment, right up to his death at 84. I wish he had reminisced more, because he had done so many interesting things in interesting places and was a fine storyteller. But getting his own past out of him was like pulling hen's teeth. Once he did describe to us what he did during the 1906 fire in San Francisco. It's in my mother's biography of him. And while he was in the remembering vein, I asked him what he felt during the earthquake and after. He worked on his pipe for a while, lighting matches and making neat little piles of them, and then he said, "Exhilaration." I don't mean to suggest that he was one of those yup-nope men. He was a highly conversable person, but he was too interested in what was happening now to look back much. I longed to know something about his first wife, Henrietta Rothschild of San Francisco, but I didn't know how to ask, and he didn't know how to answer, or there was too much old grief buried there, and he wasn't going to dig it up and display it. There is a modesty of grief, and he was a modest man. That may also be why he didn't talk about Ishi. So much old grief, old pain, still sharp. Not the cheap guilt trips the psychodramatizers pull out of their cheap hats, emotionally stunted scientist exploiting noble savage. Dr. Treves and the Elephant Man, Dr. Kroeber and Ishi. That is not what happened. It has happened, as we all know, and as he knew, but not in this case. Perhaps just the opposite. The idea that objective observation can be performed only by an observer totally free of subjectivity involves an ideal of inhuman purity which we now recognize as being, fortunately, unattainable. But the dilemma of the subjective practitioner of objectivity persists, and presents itself to anthropologists in its most acute and painful form, the relationship between observer and observed when both of them are human. Novelists, people who write about people, have the same moral problem, the problem of exploitation, but we rarely face it in so stark a form. I'm awed at the courage of any scientist who admits it in all its intractability. Looking at it from my naive, outsider's standpoint, it seems to me that most of the Boassians had a pretty strict take on it. I know my father distrusted whites, amateurs or professionals, who claimed emotional or spiritual identification with Indians. He saw such claims as sentimental and co-optative. To him, the term going native was one of disapproval. His friendships with Indians were that, friendships. Beginning in collaborative work, based on personal liking and respect, they involved neither patronization nor co-optation. With Ishii, a man almost unimaginably vulnerable in his tragic solitude, dependent by necessity, yet strong, generous, clear-minded, and affectionate, an extraordinary person in every way, this relationship of friendship must have been unusually complex and intense. My father was consciously, consistently loyal to the ideal of objective science, but it was the passions of personal grief and personal loyalty that dictated his message from New York trying to prevent the autopsy of Ishii's body. Tell them, as far as I am concerned, science can go to hell. We propose to stand by our friends. His message came too late. A contemporary anthropologist has said that if he felt so strongly about the matter, why didn't he get on an airplane and come west and see about it? One would think that an anthropologist might be aware that in 1916 there was a certain lack of airplanes to get on. A telegram was the only means he had to try to prevent the desecration. I know little of the circumstances of the subsequent grotesque division of the body, which reminds me of the way kings and emperors were buried in bits, the head in Vienna, the heart in Habsburg, other pieces in other parts of the empire. Saints the same, an arm here, a finger there, a toe in a reliquary. It would appear that to the European, dismembering a body and keeping bits of it around is a sign of respect. This is definitely a strain on our American cultural relativism. I leave it to you anthropologists to work it out. Kroeber accepted defeat and got on with the work to be done. I do not think his silence was indifference, but the muteness of undesired complicity and the dumbness of the bereaved. He had lost his friend. He had lost a person whom he loved and was responsible for, and lost him to the same sickness that had killed his wife a few years earlier, tuberculosis, the white sickness. Over and over he had worked with individuals who were among the last of their people. One way or another, his people and their white sicknesses had destroyed them. He was silent because neither he nor his science had a vocabulary for his knowledge. And if he couldn't find the right words, he wouldn't use the wrong ones. Not long after Ishii's death, my father took leave from anthropology, was psychoanalyzed, and practiced analysis for some years. But I don't think Freud had quite the words he needed either. The scope of his work and writing widened with the years, but at the very end of his life he returned to Californian ethnology, using his long-accumulated expertise to support Californian tribes in their suit against the U.S. government for restoration and reparation of their lands, spending months of testimony and cross-examination in a federal courtroom. My brother Ted, who drove him to many of these sessions, recalls the judge's attempts to give the old man a break now and then, and Alfred's patient but urgent determination to get the job done. He wrote as little about Ishii as possible. When asked about Ishii, he answered. When it was suggested he should write a biography of Ishii, he declined. Robert Heiser took the excellent expedient of offering the task to my mother, who had never known Ishii, never been his friend, was not an anthropologist, was not a man, and could be trusted to find the right words if anybody could. I was in the Lowy Museum here with Alfred Kroeber's little great-granddaughter 10 years ago, and she showed me the headphones at the Ishii exhibit where you can hear Ishii telling a story. I put them on and heard his voice for the first time. I broke into tears. For a moment. It seems the only appropriate response. Some of you may have hoped to hear more about the family or about my father's colleagues and students, who were certainly a large element in our family life. I am afraid I share Alfred's incapacity for reminiscence. I am much better at making things up than at remembering them. The two Indian friends of my father's that I can say something about, because as a child I did really relate to them, are the Papago Juan Dolores and the Yurok Robert Spot. But here I run into the moral problem we storytellers share with you anthropologists, the exploitation of real people. People should not use other people. My memories of these two Native American friends are hedged with caution and thorned with fear. What, after all, did I or do I understand about them? When I knew them, what did I know about them, about their political or their individual situation? Nothing. Not their people's history, not their personal history, not their contributions to anthropology, nothing. I was a little kid, youngest of the family. We always went up to the Napa Valley in June as soon as school was out. My parents had bought a 40-acre ranch there for $2,000. We settled in and set up the packed dirt croquet court, and Juan, a killer croquet player, always got there in time for his birthday. I was amazed to learn that Juan Dolores, a grown-up, actually didn't know what day he was born on. Birthdays were important. Mine and my brother's and my parents' were celebrated with cake and ice cream and candles and ribbons and presents, and it was a matter of great moment that one was now seven. How could it not matter to a person? In pondering this first discovery of the difference between Western time and Indian time, I was perhaps composting the soil from which the cultural relativism of my fictions would grow and flourish. But Juan, we kids called him Juan, we didn't know Spanish Juan had to have a birth date in order to fill out the papers for his Social Security or his pension from the university or something. Bureaucrats, like me, believe in birthdays. So he and my father chose him a birthday. Now, that was nifty, sitting around and deciding when you wanted to be born. They picked St. John's Eve, Midsummer Night, and thereafter, Juan's birthday was celebrated with cake, candles, and all the rest, a festival of this small tribe celebrated soon after their annual migration 60 miles to the north, marking both the summer solstice and the ritual visit of the Papago. The Papago stayed for a month or longer. The top front bedroom of the old house in the valley is still called Juan's room by the elders of the tribe. During those visits, he and my father may have worked together. I paid no attention to that. All I remember about Juan's visits is using him. The use of grown-ups by children is one of the numerous exceptions to my absolute rule that people should not use other people. Weaker people, of course, get to use stronger ones. They have to. But the limits of use are best set by the strong, not by the weak. Juan was not very good at setting limits, at least when it came to children. He let us get away with murder. We got him to make a drum for us, and as I recall, we insisted that it be a Plains Indian drum, because that was a real Indian drum, no matter that he was a real non-Plains Indian. In any case, he made a marvelous drum, and we beat on it for years. We picked up phrases like, "Lo, the poor Indian," and, from some magazine article, a title, "The Vanishing Red Man." With what is called the cruelty of children, we use these phrases. We called Juan Lo, the vanishing Papago. "Hello, Lo, you haven't vanished yet." I think he thought it was funny, too. I think if he hadn't, we'd have known it and shut up. I hope so. We weren't cruel. We were ignorant, foolish. Children are ignorant and foolish, but they learn, if they are given a chance to learn. There's a lot of poison oak in those hills, and we were all covered with calamine lotion all the time. Juan boasted that Indians never got poison oak. My brothers challenged him. "Indians don't ever get poison oak? Never? Prove it. Dare you." Juan went down on a 100-degree day into a 12-foot thicket of poison oak by the creek and cut it all down with a machete. We have a tiny Kodak picture, a sea of poison oak, one small, bald, dark head just visible in it, shining with sweat. He got tired, but he didn't get poison oak. Decades later, when I read in Sarah Winnemucca's autobiography how she nearly died as a child from her first exposure, I modified Juan's claim. Some Indians never get poison oak. It may have been that he was determined not to. He was, I think, a strong, determined man. The intellectual work he did is proof of it, which makes his endless patience with us kids even more beautiful. This memory is not my own, but of my mother's telling. Juan's first summer visit, long before he had a birthday, was the summer I learned to walk, 1931, I suppose. This infant would stagger over to Juan and say, "Go, go," and whatever he was doing, writing or reading or talking or working, Juan would excuse himself and gravely accompany me across the yard and up the driveway on a great journey of 100 yards or so, I holding on to him firmly by one finger. Now that part I do seem to remember. Perhaps it's just my mother's vivid telling, but I know which finger it was, the first of his left hand, a strong, thick, dark finger that entirely and warmly filled my hand. In the 40s, when he was living in Oakland, Juan was mugged, robbed, and badly beaten. When he came for a visit at our Berkeley house after he got out of the hospital, I was afraid to come downstairs. I had heard that his head was broken and imagined horrors. I finally was ordered down and said hello and sneaked a look. He wasn't horrible. He was tired and old and sad. I was too ashamed and shy to show him my affection. I didn't know I loved him. Children brought up in great security, tribal or familial, aren't very aware of love, as I suppose fish aren't very aware of water. That's the way it ought to be, love as air, love as the human element. But I see Juan now, a gentle, intellectual man living in exile and poverty, licensed by bigotry to be a prey of bullies. The world was full of such people in the 1940s. It is full of such people now. I wish I had had the sense to take his hand. The first time Robert Spott came to stay with us in the valley, his major problem must have been getting enough to eat. My memory of Yurok table manners is that if anybody speaks during a meal, everybody puts down their fork or soup spoon or whatever, swallows, and stops eating till the conversation is done. Only when speech is over does eating resume. Such a custom might arise among a rather formal people who had plenty to eat and plenty of time to eat it in. With that idea in mind, as a novelist, I once invented some people living on an ice age planet where food, warmth, and leisure were often hard to come by. To them, it was extremely bad manners to speak at all during a meal. Eat now, talk later, first things first. This is probably far too logical for a real custom. And I may well have misunderstood or misremembered. My brother Carl's recollection of correct Yurok table manners is that having taken a bite, one puts one spoon or hand down on the table until quite done chewing, and that also when the host stops eating, the guest stops. In any case, there was Robert, and us four kids, and Aunt Betsy, and my parents, and probably some other odd relatives or ethnologists or refugees around the dinner table, and we were a talkative and discursive and argumentative lot, with the kids encouraged to take a responsible part in the conversation. So every time anybody said anything, which was constantly, poor Robert laid down his fork, swallowed, and looked up with courteous and undivided attention while we gobbled and babbled on. As my father ate with extreme, neat rapidity, Robert must have had to stop eating before he had had anything much to eat at all. I believe he learned eventually to imitate our uncouthness. I often felt uncouth around Robert Spott. He had tremendous personal dignity and authority. I believed for years that he was a, what my linguistic nephew informs me is now pronounced shaman, but which I continue to pronounce shaman, since my father did, and it doesn't sound so New Agey. My brother Ted's memory, more enlightened than mine by 6 years, is that Robert's mother was the shaman, and that she and perhaps other women of his people trained him, not specifically as a shaman or doctor, but in the knowledge of tribal and religious customs. They demanded this learning of him, a heavy and lifelong commitment, because there was no other fit candidate, and the knowledge would die with them if he did not accept it. I have it in my head that Robert accepted the burden only with reluctance. Ted tells me that Robert served as an advocate for his people in Sacramento, taking on the then-seemingly hopeless struggle to preserve Yurok culture and values against white contempt and exploitation, a task that might daunt anyone. At the time, I understood nothing of that grim political work, and may have romanticized it by mythologizing Robert as an unwilling shaman. A girl does tend to spin romances about a handsome, stately, stern, dark man who doesn't say much. Robert was grave, serious. We took no liberties with him. Was it a cultural or a temperamental difference, or both, that Juan Dolores was long-suffering with us brats, and Robert Spot was aloof and instructive? I can still blush when I remember myself rather unusually holding the table, chattering away breakneck, telling some event of the day, and being abruptly silenced by Robert. I had far exceeded the conversational limit proper to a well-bred Yurok girl, which I imagine may be a word or two. Robert laid down his fork and swallowed, and when I paused for breath, he spoke to the adults on a subject of interest to adults. My culture told me that it is rude to interrupt people, and I was resentful, but I shut up. Children have to be stupid, or to have been culturally stupidized, not to recognize genuine authority. My resentment was an attempt to justify my embarrassment. Robert had introduced me to a very Yurok moral sentiment, shame. Not guilt. There was nothing to be guilty about, just shame. You blush resentfully, you hold your tongue, and you figure it out. I have Robert to thank in part for my deep respect for shame as a social instrument. Guilt I believe to be counterproductive, but shame can be immensely useful. If, for example, any member of Congress was acquainted in any form with shame, well, never mind. Both Juan and Robert are associated in my mind with the moving of great rocks, blue boulders of serpentine dug from the reddish dirt above the road. The menfolk and my great-aunt Betsy built a dry-laid wall of them. The end rock nearest the house, a beautiful blue-green monster, is still called by all members of the tribe Juan's Rock, though some of them may not know why. He selected it and directed and labored in the levering and rolling of it from above the driveway down to its present place. No one got killed or even maimed, though the women worried and lamented in the kitchen, and I was told 2,000 times to keep uphill from that rock. Then, or before that, there was definitely some competition between the two men, some matter of my rock is bigger than your rock. Robert built us a marvelous outdoor fireplace. It is both technically and, in fact, a sacred place. It is built as a Yurok meditation shelter is built, and so oriented, but the fire burns where the meditator would sit, and so he completed the half-circle of the shelter with a half-circle of flat stones for people to sit on around the fire. And there my people have sat for 70 years to eat and tell stories and watch the summer stars. There is a photograph of my father and Robert, one listening, the other telling, with lifted hand and faraway gaze. They are sitting on those fireplace stones. Robert and Alfred talked together sometimes in English, sometimes in Yurok. It was perhaps unusual for the daughter of a first-generation German immigrant from New York to hear him talking Yurok, but I didn't know that. I didn't know anything. I thought everybody spoke Yurok. But I knew where the center of the world was.